You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Andrew Kane.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories. We've got a spectacular show for you today. Before we get into that, I want to tell you about a sponsor, Patricia Gillum. She has a fantastic new series of superhero stories. The first one was called A Superhero's Duty. We've talked about it on the phone. And the new one is called World Gone Red. World Gone Red is a sequel to A Superhero's Duty. Daniel Spires reveals to his team and Icarus that someone has been mass abducting the children of modern heroes and villains around the world. Icarus searches for answers while dealing with the physical aftermath of his encounter with Hailstrom. His powers are fading, and a compromised hero may cost him his life. These stories are fantastic. Both of them are available for just 99 cents. World Gone Red and the first one, A Superhero's Duty. Also from Patricia, she has a fantastic series, Series Craft 101. From an author that has as much experience as Patricia does, this series is essential for people that are getting into writing and want to hone their craft. Learn from a veteran and an expert, Patricia Gillum's Series Craft 101. There's a link to her Amazon page in the show notes.
Flesh, Blood, Steel, the new book from David Alan Jones. 16-year-old Jake Harris wakes up after a horrific car accident to find 13 years have come and gone. He is 29 years old, a cyborg, and one of the world's most feared assassins. Horrified by the things he's done, things he can't remember, Jake vows never to kill again. Unfortunately, the company that owns Jake has other plans. They're not about to lose their top hitman to the errant memories of his teenage self. When Jake manages to escape them, they launch a worldwide manhunt that ranges from a near-future New York City to Paris. Desperate to remain himself, Jake joins a rebel faction dedicated to wresting control of the world's governments from the hands of militarized corporations. Using his enhanced body and perceptions, he is able to aid them in their fight, but Jake doesn't realize the rebels have their own plans for him, ones that involve unleashing his unique talents on their enemies. Faced with a dark past he can't recall and uncertain whom he should trust, Jake must come to terms with the sinister choices that molded him into the man he became. Question is, can he avoid doing it all again? Assassins aren't born, they're programmed. Flesh, Blood, Steel by David Alan Jones.
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited to have Andrea Kane on the show with me today. Andrea has a fantastic new book called Dead in a Week, and this is an excellent thriller that I think you guys are really going to love. Well, welcome to the show, Andrea.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm excited to have you. Andrea, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Okay, that would be probably the day I was born. No, I would say that I was a really, really little girl, and whenever I used to go to the dentist, when I had a good checkup, they would give me these little rubber animals, those little tiny, you know, different animals that are made out of kind of rubbery stuff.
Sure.
And I remember I used to assemble them on the floor of my bedroom, and they each were assigned a role, and I told stories in my head about them. So each of them had, you know, one would be the mother, one would be the father. It was obviously a little girl's view, but I was a storyteller forever. I can't remember ever not doing that.
I love that. You know, I hear so many stories of, and everybody has a little different story of how they came to writing or when they discovered storytelling. But for so many people, it's just one of those things that's always been there. And I love hearing that. It makes me feel not so weird.
You're definitely not weird. And you should have read my diaries after that, my long journal articles. I mean, everybody else would write, dear diary, I'm fine, love so-and-so. And I would write long things about my day at school and who was mean to me and everything.
Oh, I love it. I love it. You know, there's just, I think the earlier we learn, that writing can be cathartic and can help us process things, I think the better we are.
Exactly.
So, when you were younger and really discovered reading, when it became really important to you, what kind of books or genre or types of stories did, really captured your imagination?
Well, I definitely started out as a Nancy Drew teeth cutter. I mean, I loved that. It's far back as I can remember reading. It was that. And then when I was about third grade or so, I went through this biography stage where I wanted to read all about like Florence Nightingale and Clara Barton and all kinds of people that really fascinated me. Then I, unfortunately for my imagination, which tells you how bad I am about reading horror, I got into stuff like Mary Queen of Scots, and it was my first experience reading about a guillotine, and I just flipped out. It was so horrible to see someone beheaded, and I didn't sleep for I don't know how long. And I remember thinking that that she had that done to her at that same age my mom was. So until my mom turned to the next year, I was hysterical that something terrible was going to happen to her. Just shows how weird the writer's mind is.
Oh, yeah, but the other side of that is it's always fascinating to hear what those early influences are, because those things have a tendency to follow us into adulthood and then into the writing that we do, that love of mystery, that fascination with the macabre on some level tends to seep into the stories that we tell.
Yes, you're right.
So Andrea, at what point did you know you were going to be a writer? And that's why I make a distinction between storytelling and writing. I think storytellers are born, and then if you want to take that and work on it and tell stories for other people, you know, then we study writing and we work at the craft of that. At what point did you know you wanted to write books?
I always had this dream, but it's never, I don't think that you ever can say to yourself, I know I'm going to be an accomplished novelist, because it just seems like such a lofty aspiration. I remember I wrote all kinds of, not journal articles, but more essay pieces that were published in high school things nationwide and stuff. But those were not creative as much as they were just, you know, reporting sort of stuff. But what happened was when I started because I cut my teeth in terms of writing on historical romantic suspense before I got into suspense thrillers. So I was reading them like 100 a day, and I started doing book reviews from at the time it was called Romantic Times as opposed to RT Reviews. And that taught me a lot. It taught, first of all, I read extensively because of it. It also taught me a lot about writing, and it taught me what I liked and didn't like. And it also taught me, of all things, how to be very terse and make things very concise. And I knew that I could never do that. Even though I did it for the reviews, I knew that if I wrote, there was no way it was going to be short. And I've been told by some of the FBI consultants I work with that my emails are novels unto themselves. So I guess that's true.
That's fantastic.
So I guess the answer is always, but never did I believe that I could do it until I actually sat down and did it. And that was I was doing the shorter things, like the reviewing, when my daughter was little and still home, because I was sort of doing both. I was managing being a full-time mom at the same time as I was doing that. And when she went to actual kindergarten is when I sat down and said, I'm going to try this, because I'm getting to a point where I'm saying, oh, I would have done this a little differently, or, you know, oh, what if this had happened instead? So I thought, that's it. Instead of being so arrogant, just think that this could have been better. Write your own and see if it is.
Well, for a lot of people, there's a moment of realization. Maybe it's when we read a particular book and say, oh, my goodness, I think I could do this better, or I could at least do as well. Sometimes that's kind of a negative connotation. Sometimes there's someone that, you know, puts an idea, forth to us, and it's something we've already been thinking about, but it's just that positive reinforcement. Was there any particular moment for you, or was it just this building thing that I'm surrounded by books and stories, and I do all this stuff about books. Maybe I should give it a try myself.
It was probably a building thing, I would say, because there, I can't remember a moment where I just said, I always felt like it was too arrogant to say to myself, you can write a novel, but I always thought maybe I'd like to try. So as I built through this, and I learned all through the things that I was doing, so it helped me feel like a little more confident that I could sit down and do it. But actually, the idea of sitting down and doing it was an increasing feeling of I would do this differently, or gee, I'd like to try this. And my biggest thing was, what if I could combine a really good historical romance with a really solid suspense? Because that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to write a plain historical romance. There's anything wrong with that, but I wanted to put a heavy element of suspense in it. So I did. That's what I started out by doing. And I did that until I reached the point where I thought, my voice is starting to come out more contemporary. I'm going someplace else and I can feel it, so it's time to reassess.
What year was that when you started writing those books?
Which ones?
The ones where you, the romantic suspense where you're mixing the genre. I guess what I'm asking is, was that something that was happening in the market already, or were you kind of forging from some new territory?
There were elements of it that I had read, but not as much of a, I would say, a 50-50 balance that I was kind of trying to strive for. And it was 1991 when my first book came out. Now, I'm only 24 years old. So
Of course.
I was in utero that I wrote.
Right. Right. You had a medium that was helping you or something.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
You sold me. I'm with you. when you started wanting to merge those genres and tell the kind of stories that really appealed to all of your interest, were there people interested in those kinds of stories? What was it like getting them out to the world?
Well, the good part was that everybody loved the stories. The bad part was that it was hard getting it out because the bookstore owners and the various, because at that time it wasn't an Amazon world. It was, it was a brick and mortar world.
Right.
They didn't know how to rack the books because they didn't want to rack them as romances. They didn't want to rack them as suspenses because that was all the contemporaries. And they really didn't know what to do with it. So we ended up finally, I think it was mostly in historical romance. It was sometimes in mystery. It was sometimes in suspense. It was kind of a little of everywhere. But I understood there wasn't an assigned name to that kind of a novel. And they really didn't. When people wrote time travel, for example, that still was an historical romance that still went back and forth between the future and the past, or the present and the past. But it was still primarily an historical romance, and they knew where to put it. They didn't know where to put me, and that made it more difficult. My daughter, who was really in kindergarten at that point, was basically walking into bookstores, taking my book and making it face out on the shelf and screaming out, "Look, it's that new wonderful book by Andrea Kane!" So that all the customers would come running over.
Oh, man. We all wish we had someone like that in our life.
And a child can get away with it.
Oh, of course. That is fantastic. That is fantastic. Well, even though we do live in an Amazon world, I think authors still struggle with categories and genre. And especially if you write a story that's a little weird for the current, taste and market. The landscape has changed, but I think we still deal with some of that and trying to find exactly who your ideal reader is and getting the word out to them.
You're absolutely right, because people will say to me, do you write romantic suspense? Do you write suspense thrillers? Do you write pure suspense? And honestly,
and
I used
yes.
to say I write, yes, because I used to say I write psychological thrillers, because that in a sense, a lot of what I write. But then I look at it and I say, well, characterization is hugely important to me. So I can't say that the relationships in my books aren't significant, because they are. And you're right. It's like, yes, is the answer.
Well, at what point did you feel like that you got a foothold? Because you've gone on to hit the New York Times bestseller list. Your books have found an audience for sure. How deep into this were you before you felt like that you had found your people?
My first transition into contemporary stuff. When I reached the last of my 14 historical romantic suspenses, and I knew at that point that it was time, I just knew my voice had changed. that's when I wrote Run for Your Life, which was my first, at that point, I considered a romantic suspense because it was heavier still because I was making the transition. It was heavier on the romance. So I made that transition, and it just felt really right. And that was actually my first book that hit the New York Times list. So I just knew the voice was changing. You know, people had asked me often, did you do this because one was more popular than the other? And the truth is, I don't really think, at least I'm capable of writing for the market. I need to write the book that's inside me to write. So to say, well, this is more popular, so that's what I'll do, I can't.
Right.
It just happened to work out.
Well, you brought up a really great point that I don't think we get to talk about enough, and that is the writer's voice. And we hear a lot of people give advice to new writers that, you know, you need to find your voice. What makes you unique? What we never talk about, though, is that your writer's voice has a tendency to change. And as your the things that excite you change, and the genres that you enjoy change, and as you mature, as you have more life experience, your writer's voice can change. Can you speak to that just a little bit about how you matured as a writer and that you found yourself changing?
First of all, that was so well put what you just said that I don't think I can even top it with an answer. But it's because it is so true. We all transition as writers, and nobody is the same. You can even look back on some of my previous books, and I'll think, wow, I would not have done it that way. That was really too obvious, or the red herring wasn't as strong as I would want it to be, or that kind of thing. So the transition happened as I tried to deepen my characters. And also, I'm not good at not writing a complex novel, which is great, but it's not so great because it means that I can't be one of those wonderful people who puts out 6 books a year. I'm one a year and that's it. I just can't, because between all of the levels of research that I'd have to do and all the different layers I'm peeling back, I definitely think those things were what matured along the way. The characterization depths and the certainly the amount of research that I have to do, but the complexity of the plots, there was no longer just one antagonist that was clear and obvious, and it became a lot of different red herrings, and the plot started getting more complex, and I could feel that evolving in me as time went on. So I would say that would be the most major transitional things that I can speak to.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to trust that. Do you have to, I guess, learn to know your voice enough and to trust in your skill that you've gained over the years to know when it's time to make a move?
You do. But I think as writers, we never stop being insecure. I really don't know any writer, at least one who hasn't become complacent about their craft, who isn't worried all the time, you know, is this book as good as it could be? People used to say to me earlier on that I was so much of a perfectionist that even after I'd finally gone through the book 3,000 times and I'd finally sent it on its way, in those days, not by email, but by the UPS truck, and everybody would say to me, we see you running after the UPS truck. Stop! I have another change I want to make.
People don't understand what it's like, I think, sometimes. I've interviewed lots of authors. Some of them, every book that they publish, you know, debuts at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. There are some names that are instantly recognizable by everyone on planet Earth. And what's interesting is that everyone's story is the same, that when you publish that book and you go back to the computer or the notebook or the typewriter or whatever to start the next book, everyone feels like a fraud. Like, okay, that last thing, that was a fluke. I'll never be able to do it again.
Exactly.
You know, and it's starting from ground zero every single time. That it's, you know, writing, I think, is unique in that sense that when the blank slate comes up, it's really a blank slate every time.
Yeah, it's like starting a new job every time you start a new book.
right. You know, at least
you
athletes...
walk in, you don't know the people, you don't know the place, you don't know what you're doing, and you keep thinking somebody else must have done the other one because I didn't.
Exactly. You know, I think you know, even athletes in the off season can still go to the gym and maintain, you know, physical fitness, and then when spring training starts, it's kind of easing back into the thing you were already doing. But you know, when especially if you're not writing in a series and you've got to come up with a new idea, new characters, and it can be crippling for people. After publishing more than 25 books, how do you deal with those feelings of starting a new project?
I'm usually overwhelmed. There's a part of me that wants to press page down and hope that some writer's muse has written something for me to start. Because the right. beginning is so overwhelming. I mean, even if I have, and I always have, some degree of an outline, which changes throughout the whole book anyway, and is usually nothing like the book when I finish it. But even having that, I sit down and I think, well, how am I beginning this? What am I doing? Am I starting with a specific character? Am I starting with, and then I have a tendency to want to like say everything all at once, which is ridiculous because then I would be one chapter into a book and be done. So it goes all over the place. Sometimes it's easier. Sometimes it'll be a book where I have a really strong feeling about the onset. Doesn't mean the whole book will be that way. But with Dead in a Week, I was a mess because this was literally the hardest book I ever had to write. And, you know, we'll talk about it obviously later on, but I'm just saying it was so difficult for me because I was starting with not only a brand new group that was joining the Forensic Instincts team, which I had written a bunch of books, so that this is all a series, but so I had a new core group that I had to deal with, and I also had to do all of this international research because so much of the book takes place in Croatia and in Munich, and I've never done that before. So I was such a mess when I was, plus I had never done industrial espionage. This was the whole new realm in so many different ways. I drove my sources crazy. I know I did, but I'm a perfectionist and I had to do it exactly right. So there are books that are easier. There's, you know, one or two that I could think of that came more readily if they were spinoffs, for example, and I already knew that character that had his or her own story. But still in all, each one of them has a whole new storyline, a lot of research that goes along with that storyline, then a whole new set of other characters that comes along with that. So it's not ever where you just sit down and say, I'm cool. You know, it's just you sit down and you generally say, oh my God, why did I ever decide? Well, I wanted to do this when I grew up.
you have gotten to see a lot of changes in publishing over the last couple of decades. And we've talked about the benefits of living in an Amazon world, and there are drawbacks to that as well. But what are some of the big things that you've seen that have affected you as a writer in the changes in publishing, good or bad, whatever your instinct is at the moment?
I think that it was a much bigger, I think that it's changed so much because, first of all, self-publishing has changed a great deal. That's a whole new realm that wasn't in existence. But I think that there's a lot of things that are more difficult in terms of how to reach. I don't know exactly how to phrase this. I don't want to say that publishing is a dinosaur business, but in a lot of ways it is. I mean, they're still, like, for example, they will still lay out the same book tour and that was effective years ago but isn't effective now. And I always want to shake them and say, you know, you need to move with the times, so to speak, because things are very different now. And now also there are things that are easier, such as, you know, I can reach people through wonderful people like you, whereas at the beginning it was, you know, national tours. And that's exhausting for a writer because much as I love meeting people, I love meeting my readers. That's always so great because I get to hear their feedback, good and bad. And believe me, they tell you both. But the problem is that I would get myself psyched for at least a week or two before, and then I would come home and be brain dead a week or two after. So I not only lost the time of the tour, I know some people can actually write when they're on tour, but I can't. I'm totally about the tour and what I'm each place that I'm going. I mean, like this morning, I looked through some things to, you know, to pinpoint what I was going to have some idea of what to talk about. I didn't know how we would be weaving and flowing, but I had some idea that I wasn't just going to sit there like a moron when you asked me a question. So I'm very propelled by some degree of, you know, locking on what I'm doing. And I don't know that publishing has grown as quickly as it needs to in terms of changing, in terms of modernizing. I think that that's probably the biggest problem it has now. It was a more lucrative world, of course, years ago. I mean, people made the sums of money like you're talking about when you discuss the ball players. Now that's changed considerably, and you know the economy has changed, so that's of course a very negative effect. But I think that control has always been very difficult. It, you know, it's nice to be able to control your covers. It's nice to be able to control the timing of your release dates, and none of that has changed. That's publisher control, and very frustrating for a writer. I don't think any of that's really changed.
It's very much the world of the working writer now. The idea that you are, you know, alone in your writing cabin, and you at the end you throw your manuscript down the hill, and your publisher picks it up, and then you've got 6 months to goof off and think about the next project before starting over again.
You just said that perfectly.
Yeah, it's just not that world, is it?
No, it's a very hard world because, you know, you're writing one book, you're promoting another book, you're trying to think of an idea for the next book, and it's very hard to give everything your all. Plus, you know, you also have a personal life with a family and everything else, so you're juggling an awful lot. What I admire so much are people that have full-time jobs other than their writing, and then their writing, and then their families and their other things, because I couldn't. This has always been, it's who I am, it's what I do, and once I started the novel writing, then I was doing that full time, and that was it. I don't know that I could have locked down on another thing.
Right. Well, let's talk about the new book. The newest thing that you have, it comes out today. When people are hearing this, it is release day. It's called Dead in a Week. It's the Zermatt Group thriller book 7, I think it is. Tell us what's going on in the story and who are the people that we meet.
Okay, well, first of all, it's actually, although you were right about Zermatt, but the Forensic Instinct series is really, it's very confusing because it is the Forensic Instinct series, but this is the first time they're teaming up with the Zermatt group. So it was like dealing with some old friends and bringing on some new friends.
Gotcha.
And the new friends were the hard part because the old friends I know well. And when I'm involved in one of their stories, I know them really thoroughly. But this was where they were joining forces with a new team and a very different team. They're much more global, and they have a much more global and much more covert presence. I call them the Core Four because there's four of them. But they come from all different backgrounds, mostly, you know, corporate giants, military, some of them from the FBI, that sort of thing. So it's military and spy agency operatives. And what they do is they search the data stream for troubling events in an increasingly troubling world, and then they take on these near impossible global cases. So this was one of those cases, and Aiden Devereaux, who is the leader of the group, he calls Von Paul not only his team, but Forensic Instincts, because he's actually made an appearance in a couple of those books beforehand, because his brother Mark is one of the key members of Forensic Instincts. So he has helped out them, and in this case, he calls them to help him out. So that's probably the best joining I can describe. I know it sounds very convoluted, but it's Zermatt's first, it's their entree, but it's Forensic Instincts' seventh appearance.
Gotcha. And the book, the thing that kind of kicks all this off is we've got Laura Pennington, celebrating her junior year abroad, and things happen. And this kicks off this whole international, incident. Tell us what the motivation, behind this, kind of plot, that kicks us into the story.
Well, first of all, this was unusual for me because Aiden was there. He was sort of in my head and there, and I needed to just flesh him out and move on from him. That part is typical of the way I write. But what wasn't typical was that I usually don't focus on something that's really ongoing in the current news, and this was. This was about all of the current news situations that are going on about industrial espionage targeting U.S. tech companies. It was just in my face. Everywhere I looked, it just kept popping up. And then came the what if. And I thought, you know, what if there was a Silicon Valley company that was about to release, you know, groundbreaking technology that would bring a huge chunk of manufacturing back to the U.S. from China? And how far would the Chinese tech companies go to stop that from happening? That was how it started. So then I invented Nano USA, which was the company in Silicon Valley. And from there, it was the more personal angle, which is always the one that I feel most comfortable with and I think touches people the most, because instead of just making it about, a news story, so to speak, came one of the VPs of the company, and the way they went about it was kidnapping his young daughter, teenage daughter, as you just said, who was junior year abroading, and she was in Germany, and they kidnapped her and held her with the people that they hired to kidnap her were terrorists of the worst sort, and they were keeping her, and the idea was, you want her back, you supply us with the technology, or she's dead in a week. So poor Vance Pennington was horrified, but what was more fun was the fact that Zermatt picked up on it before he did. So Aiden flew out there to talk to him and tell him, and as he came out into the office to talk to him about it, that's when Vance got the texts from the kidnappers saying what they wanted or what would happen to Lauren, and pictures of the fact that they had her. So it was kind of scary even as I was writing it, but it was emerging in my mind this time as an onset. Usually it's a character or a thought, or sometimes it's a news story, but not an ongoing series like that where I kept seeing this and thinking, this, I have to do something with this. It's appealing to me.
Right.
So I don't know if I answered the question or talked
Absolutely.
Around it.
Absolutely. No, it's perfect. It's perfect. You said earlier that that you used to say that you wrote psychological thrillers, and you broadened that scope recently. When writing a book like this that has such a large stage and a broader cast of characters, when you're writing psychological thriller, I think by name and definition, you think of you're really inside someone's head or inside someone's experience.
Yes.
And it's very personal. Other than that, is there a difference in writing those kinds of books? Besides just the stage is different in writing a book like this compared to one of those kind of personal psychological thrillers?
I think that with this one, that's why it was harder for me, because there was less inside your head type of stuff and more plot driven stuff. So even though I focus heavily on all of my plots, they're not as intensive as this one was, where I spent a great deal of time learning military things and learning technology things and things that are not my natural landing pad, where I feel it's outside my comfort zone. That's the best way to put it. This book was way outside my comfort zone. So the parts where I was, for example, inside Lauren's head or inside her parents' head, that I could totally be inside and relate to. I understood. Fortunately, it's never happened to me, but I understood because I was them, and I understood my God, this horrible. They could do nothing. They could do nothing but trust Zermatt and sit back and follow directions and not contact anybody and not get anyone involved to save their baby, because this was their youngest of three children. That part, and inside Lauren's head being held in this horrible situation, those parts came more naturally to me. It's not so much easier, but more naturally. But this book had so much of a broader scope that I had to spend an inordinate amount of time on the landscape, so to speak. And actually what happened was the FBI put me in touch with one of their liaisons out, who was stationed in Austria but had Croatia as part of her territory, and she saved my life, that's for sure. She literally visited all these places for me. She put me in touch with all of the law enforcement there that I needed to, even the farmers that I needed to talk to because of the locale, and she visited Croatia and different cities there a number of times for me. She took videos. She sent me so much, and she connected me with so much that, when you read the acknowledgments, the reason the acknowledgments of my book are so long is because she just made so much possible. And these people were so accommodating. They were kind and they were sharing. And I was very grateful because I went in a total newbie. I'd never been to Croatia. I knew only what I could research online, which is never three-dimensional enough to satisfy me. So this book was so much broader in that kind of international scope that it made it that much harder for me to write. So you're right. The psychological thriller elements are there, and they're my comfort zone. But this was way outside my comfort zone and took up a lot of the book.
How much planning and pre-writing goes into a book like this before the actual drafting starts?
A lot. First of all, I usually do anywhere between 3 to 4 months of research before I even start writing the book. I will start the outline during that time, but that's why the book takes me a year, because what happens is I do all this research, and I'm usually in touch with people who either specific to the subject or specific to the area or whatever I need, and the law enforcement people I need to talk to, and branching out from there. And then what happens is, as I'm doing things along the way, even writing the book, I have new questions that come up and I have to reconnect with them. So ahead of time, I do a lot of the researching and I do all the fleshing out that I can possibly think to do. Like with Zermatt, again, it was Aiden and three other people, you know, Simone and Philip and Terry, who were the team. And I had to develop them as human beings, not just as names and just not just as people on a page. So I needed to flesh them all out. And that was very hard because, again, that takes a great deal of time. So I will do sketches and I will do a rough outline. But I always say rough because eventually what I end up doing, which is the thing that works best for me, is by the time I'm into the book a little, I divide it into thirds. And I almost do a third of an outline, a third of an outline, a third of an outline, so I know what's coming. And it changes. I always say it's like looking across this vast ocean and seeing buoys along the way and hoping that they stay the same, but they never do. They move. So as you're swimming, you have to swim to a new target, but at least they're there, so they're comforting to know they're there, as opposed to having nothingness between you and the other end of the ocean. That would kill me. I know there are people who write without an outline, and sometimes people write without knowing who did it. I could never do either of those. It's just not me. So
I think
that
would drive me crazy. I think that would drive me crazy writing a book like this. And a lot of people are somewhere in between, where we have a roadmap, but leave a little room. But I have to know where I'm going. That would drive me crazy to not know who did it and how it's going to resolve, I think.
I wouldn't be able to do it also because I'm busy trying to weave that person innocuously into the book. And
sure.
Also, at the same time, I'm also putting in my red herrings and the sort of subplots within the plots. And I don't know how you can do that without knowing who did it.
Right, right. And you've done it so well in this book. The book is dead in a week. It's out everywhere today. I highly recommend this book. Andrea, it's been so much fun talking with you. Is there a place where people can find you online if they're just learning about you and want to dig into your massive back catalog and learn more about you?
Absolutely, at www.andreakane.com, and that will also be able to link people to, there's excerpts of all my books, there's buyability, you know, you can link to different sites to buy the book, and you can even see all kinds of background stuff, which is fun, about how I work with the FBI and all kinds of other tidbits like that. So that's the central place to go, because then you can connect to Facebook and Twitter and every place else from there. That would be my suggestion.
Great. Andrea, we're going to put links to all that in the show notes for people to find easily. And we wish you much success on the book launch. Thanks so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
On Walpurgis night, when the moon is high, hell's bells ring and witches must answer. They dapple their breasts with rendered fat of murdered babes, straddle their brooms and take to the sky, as the devil wills, to speed through dreamy midnight air to the summit of the Brockenberg, that haunted peak shrouded in swirling mists, where a glen of gnarled limbs and wan moonlight awaits to host their debauches and blasphemies. Now to the Brocken the witches ride. The stubble is gold and the corn is green. There shall the carnival's sabbat be seen, and the devil shall come to preside. The accuser elopes from the bowels of hell, a sure-footed, goat-headed, many-horned beast with cloven hooves and a staff of bone. He perches upon the witch altar to brood in cerulean half-light, a winged silhouette with watchful red eyes. The witches gather and bow to their master, upon his charred rump give the shameful kiss, then imps beat the drum and a round dance begins. Lash yourselves into frenzy, hags! Pass the chalice of pure marrow broth. Whip the ground with your hair, tread the sky with your feet, dance with joined hands around Satan's cold fire. Then find out a nook of nettles and moss, and lay with the rough-skinned beast of your choosing, suckling some rancid teat of desire. But hist! The cock crows. Away, away! Gather your tatters and broomsticks and wits back to your huts, to your thresholds and hearths, and become once more, at the red break of day, the furtive adder in your neighbor's garden. The ghost host of the Salem Sorcery Tour, dazzling in his steampunk Victorian morning crepe, let the spell he'd woven trail through the twilight air like a hag across the moon, then chirped, "Isn't that silly?" and bowed, sweeping the wet grass with his satin-ribboned top hat. The tour group gave a polite round of applause. Nobody believes that stuff today, but the Puritans sure did. They took witches very seriously. If they went down in the morning and bought eggs, and one was rotten, surely the devil had come in the night, gone boop, tee-hee-hee, then scampered off on his little hooves. And who's in league with the devil? Witches. We're taught that the Puritans were super nice and cute with little buckles on their hats, but it's not the case, folks. They were fanatics. Witch hunts don't happen in a healthy society. They hated kids. They hated women. They were crazy. And that craziness. He turned on the spot, casting a protective circle around the stone garden of the witch memorial. Got these people killed.